So this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Flight Lieutenant Richard Acton, who's being interviewed on the 22nd of March at his home in View Royal by Daniel Shade. Flight Lieutenant Acton, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, by all means.
Excellent. Certainly. Okay, so getting started, I'd like to know just a little bit about how you entered the Royal Canadian Air Force and how you became a pilot.
Okay. I started off, I joined in 1951. At that time, they were seemed to be recruiting technicians. That was the big thing. So I was recruited as a radar technician, trained in Clinton, Ontario, and went out to 435 Squadron in Edmonton. I was there for about a year and a half, and I kept noticing the young officers going back and forth, talking to them. I decided I was probably as smart as they were, so I put in a remuster for air crew, and I made that in the summer of 1953. Then went, and with my background in as a radar technician, etc., I was immediately slotted into the radio officer category. And after a year and a half of training, air crew training, various courses in Clinton, Ontario, and Winnipeg, Manitoba, I was trained on the Transport Command Officer Training Unit in Trenton, where we flew two transatlantic flights over to Europe and a couple of flights across northern Canada. So, in other words, from September of 53 to January of 55, I completed my aircrew training and then was posted to 408 Squadron in the spring of 1955. So that was my background. By the time I graduated from the aircrew training, I had the old RCF rank of pilot officer. Mind you, I was trained as a radio officer, but anyway, that's the way it went. So
when you had learned that you were being posted to 408, were you aware of the work they were doing at the time? Were you
not at all? I knew that it would not be flying across the Atlantic around Europe, etc., where I was experienced with the operational training unit. I knew that it would be flying in the Arctic instead, which I guess I wasn't all that pleased about it, but it's one experience I think I look back on more fondly than some others, because it was a very interesting period.
Right. Why is that? I'm sure we'll get into it, but did anything stand out upon your joining the squadron?
No, on joining the squadron, I found it was, I would say, the biggest squadron in the RCF at the time, because it previously had been two squadrons, 414 and 408, and they rolled them all into one on 408. So it was a very large squadron with quite a big operation every summer with the Charan operations. It took a lot of aircraft, a lot of support aircraft, and the Lancasters for doing the Charan flying work.
Right.
So I guess my impressions on joining the squadron was that it was a job I was sent to do, so that's the way it went, and I made the best of it. In fact, I think I probably was one of the people who had probably the best posting out of 408 as to anyone at my time.
Why is that? What was?
I don't know. I'm not sure, but I think I did a good job on 408. I think I was probably one of the best radio officers on the squadron. I tended to gather that from what some other people had said, but at any rate, I left squadron 408 squadron and was posted to the Canadian Joint Staff in London, England, and flying VIP aircraft around Europe. I mean, it was the best job I ever had. It was,
wow.
Every night was in a different European capital, NATO capital, you know, and flying back and forth to Paris. NATO headquarters was right downtown in Paris, just by the Eiffel Tower, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
And we flew back and forth to there almost on a weekly basis, and quite often we'd spend a night, if we had the chairman over at a conference, we'd stay with him until the conference was over, so we'd just sightsee around Paris. It was rather good.
Wow.
So anyway, going back to 408, it was an interesting period of my life.
Well, can you tell me what you did on 408, what aircraft you flew?
Okay. I started off flying on the Dakota aircraft, or we'll say the civilian version was the DC-3. The American military version was the C-47.
That's ready when you want it.
Yeah, would you like
to? Would you like me to? Yeah.
So the first month or two, I was flying regularly on the Dakota aircraft with one the operational flight, which I've described in my notes I did on the Council flying boat.
Really? Sorry, now, so what are you taking
I,
that?
I think it was because some of the people, you know, flying regularly, some people that have colds and things like that, and being a very junior man on the squadron, I was always plugged in to fill in for them, so that's why I sort of drifted from the Dakota to the Canso to finally flying on the Lancasters.
So did you do any? You had mentioned the Shore Dedic or the Shoran work with 408. Had you flown any of those Shoran operations during the time? Or
yes. In the summer of 55, let's see, I'll just look in my logbook here. Okay. For starters, the detachment we had in 1955 was at Whitehorse in the Yukon. There was an RCS station there. And we got going in early June of 1955. We got established in Whitehorse. And through the month of June, I was flying mainly on Dakota aircraft, with one exception. Towards the end of June, I made that one trip on the Canso, which was quite an interesting installation. It was a Shoran installation, just not far from a place called the Fort Good Hope on the Mackenzie River. Now, I mentioned that in my notes, but this was quite an interesting flight because, for one thing, we flew up along the Mackenzie, landed on the Mackenzie, tied up the Canso on the shoreline, and then walked up to the village because we had quite a big job ahead of us, and we wanted to hire some local staff to help us. So it was walking up towards the village, which was about maybe half a mile or so from where we beached the aircraft. Coming, approaching the village, we were surrounded by dozens of Eskimo sled dogs, these were Indian sled dogs, and they'd been turned loose for the summer just to fend for themselves. So of course they were not friendly or unfriendly. I guess they were more curious or something, but they were a little disturbing. They were big dogs, and there was a whole pack of them. So, but finally, one of the locals called them off, and we went up, went into the chief's house because we wanted to discuss hiring some of the locals. So we got the discussion going, and I happened to notice one of the the sides from one of the people, one of the local people said, the pilot on this canso was a Métis fellow by the name of Ray Brassa. And I heard one of the locals say, that's Johnny's brother. No, Johnny Brassa was a very famous bush pilot who went missing about 2 years before. He had engine trouble, landed his float plane on a lake, and sat there for about a week. He wasn't rescued. Apparently he was running short of food, so he left a note saying that he was walking out, but he was never seen again. They found his aircraft another week or two later, but they never did find him. So anyway, that was the fact that Ray was Johnny's brother probably helped us in this discussion. But anyway, Ray pulled out a booklet full of Hudson's Bay Company script, and we decided on a cost for half a dozen of their youths, and he wrote a piece of script for the payment of, I think it was something like $80 in the local Hudson's Bay store. That's how we paid them.
Wow.
And with that, there was six of us and about six of the local lads. They're from what they call now, they call the Dani Nation. You know, they were not big fellows. They're quite smaller than we were, but very strong, very, very wiry. We had to move about maybe 2,000 to 3,000 pounds of gear up this local hill, which was 1,000 feet high. So it took about 5 or 6 trips for each one of us, you know, carrying a load of 30 or 40 pounds. And something like the radar set and the radio transmitter were quite heavy. We carried them on a stretcher, you know, one of these stretchers, which they always had in aircraft, and with 4 people carrying it, you know, just that was, but anyway, it took us from probably early afternoon until well into the evening to do that installation. The weather was probably well into the 90s, a very hot day, and we stripped down to our waist, carrying this stuff up. But then I recall being bitten by horseflies that were just attacking us. But I noticed that the local Indian lads, that didn't bother them. They seemed to have some bug repellent from probably something that which they had developed themselves. But anyway, we finished the installation, left the 3 men, 3 airmen, which would be manning the station, left them there, and they'd be there for maybe 2 to 3 weeks, sometimes longer, depending on how long it took to fly all the Charan transits. So with that, then we got back in the canso and back to Whitehorse. So it was an interesting day, a long day, hard work, etc., but it was quite an interesting day. I guess I mentioned that because that would be sort of a typical installation where we had to put these 3 men with their radar set, their communications set, and all of their tents, food supplies, etc. They had 2 tents, actually one for sleeping in and the other for their equipment. And it was usually on the highest point of land in the area. Perhaps I should go back, step back a bit and describe how the Charan operation worked.
Sure, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. The Canadian government decided after the war that they had to survey and make maps for all of the Northern Territories, because there was nothing had been done before that. All the maps contained where the major lakes and rivers, which were put there by early explorers, etc. The rest of the area was blank. In fact, flying along, you'd have a blank chart, and usually the navigator would draw in the details as he flew along. That's what we had before, so this had to be done, and this was a big job, was mapping the Canadian North. And they started working on it back in the probably around 46, 47, started doing the photo coverage. For the photo coverage, they had about an 8 to 10 inch lens camera mounted on the aircraft. They flew along at average flight height of maybe 5 or 6 thousand feet, and if they had good visibility, not too much clouds, they could get some fairly accurate and fairly detailed pictures off the terrain. This was done covering the whole area. Then following that, they had to decide the distances between the points, and to do that, we got a U.S. Air Force blind bombing set developed around the end of World War II called Charan, which was a radar set which transmitted signals, and the aircraft could fly out to a midpoint of two stations and fly out to the, and by collecting two stations could get a very accurate position. Now, we modified that slightly by setting ground stations, which I described as installing one ground station. We setting these ground stations about roughly 200 miles apart, and they were covered the whole northern area. We had some anchor stations which were determined very accurately on the globe by the geodetic people, would have taken star shots for weeks on end to establish their accurate position. Then with that, all we had to do was find the distance between each of these stations, and then that way you would have, in fact, by doing the whole network with the interconnecting lines between the stations, you would have measured the distance between three sides of a triangle, and you'd have the distances down very accurately. Now, the way we did that was we had a radar set on the Lancaster aircraft and another radar set in each of the ground stations. So the aircraft would fly out to the midpoint of the line between two ground stations, have them fire up their radars. They would start transmitting signals. The aircraft would fly transits at the midpoint, or roughly the midpoint of the line between the two stations. And we had cameras recording the signals coming in from both stations, and of course measuring the time that took, which would give you an extremely accurate distance within feet of the 200 miles or so distance. So that gave us a very accurate measurement, and to make the accuracy even more, when we flew out to the midpoint of the two stations to start doing the transits, the geodetic people wanted us to take dry bulb and wet bulb temperatures at from the ground level every 1,000 feet up to the area where you had good reception from the two stations, and you flew your transits. Now, talking about good reception, in the mountainous area in the Yukon, on one flight in the summer of 1955, to pick up the signals from the two ground stations, we had to climb to 29,000 feet, which was pretty high with an old World War II aircraft with World War II oxygen equipment, nothing pressurized or anything like that, just in the old demand oxygen mask equipment. But anyway, that's that is more or less how the operation was conducted. These grounds, going back to the ground stations, they, as I said, they'd been out there for weeks at a time. They're generally resupplied either by air drop or if they're near a lake or something like that, by either the Canso or the, we had the Otter aircraft. We just started flying Otter aircraft, which were very good for landing on lakes and going up to resupply them. So these were very remarkable guys that were manning these stations. In fact, once they got onto, they seemed to like it, because they stayed on for years, year after year, until the whole operation was finished. They were rather raunchy guys. When they came out, I guess they're ready for a party, because I must say that after the detachment had closed, I flew back on a Dakota aircraft, and our mission was to pick up about a dozen of these guys who had been in the Air Force jail or the Air Force brig for various misdemeanors after they'd come out of the bush. But anyway, it took a pretty carefree, raunchy individual to do some of these jobs, but it was done, and they did very well.
So
carry on.
No, this is fantastic. That was actually my next question, was the personalities of the type of individuals who would walk into the bush for three or four days at a time.
They were, we'll say, gems in the rough. Yeah.
So what about your role on the Shoreline Survey, if you were flying the Lancasters? From your perspective, what was that job like?
Yeah, it was rather interesting seeing how the operation worked. Actually, my main job was communications, because one of the navigators was operating the Charan set, which just meant turning it on and at the right time and turning the camera on, and that did all the work. But I guess there were two different types of flying. The Lancaster was, involved in the high-level Charan work, doing this, recording these radar signals, etc., to do the mapping. But an interesting job was flying support for them, like putting in the ground stations and things like that. Another thing, in early June of that year, we were based in Whitehorse, but we wanted to have an advanced base at Norman Wells in the Northwest Territories. So the detachment commander, Squadron Leader Ken Brown, actually he was a wartime dam buster, mm-hmm. quite a colorful individual, but he went along with the crew I was on over to Norman Wells to have a look at the place. Now, this had been an RCO station during World War II. It had been pretty well shut down at the end of the war, used only maybe sporadically for searches and things like that since then. So we flew over, to have a look at it to see whether we could use it, and then he decided we could. So actually we spent a night there sleeping in the old mess hall in our sleeping bags, and then next day we took off flying up to the Arctic coast, because at that time they were just starting to install the dew line stations. We really didn't have much information about them at all, because this was a very sort of a secret operation. But we were given just a sheet of paper, stamped secret, but it had the Latin long of these stations and their beacon frequency, aircraft beacon frequency. So with that we flew in and landed on, one was Clinton Point, and I know because we landed there and went in and sort of bummed a lunch from their installation. But interestingly enough, on that station, there was a U.S. Air Force full colonel who was obviously in charge. When we went into the mess hall for lunch, he was in there. I saw him look at us with quite a frown on his face, and then decided to ignore us completely. In other words, he his first reaction, oh, how dare these interlopers come into my American base, and then thinking it over, saying, well, actually, this is Canada too, so I better keep quiet. So, but anyway, that was just a bit of a sideline. But with that, Ken Brown decided that, yes, these stations could be used as alternates for flying up in that area, which was well and good now. Later on in the summer, when I was flying on Lancasters, we did deploy to Norman Wells, and what happened was that they flew two young cooks over to start feeding us, except they had to fire up this gas range or kitchen stove range or what have you, a great big stove, to start cooking, and they didn't know much about it, so one of them burnt himself quite badly, and then with that they refused to try to light it again. So there we were. It started to rain. The runways were all gravel, so they were far too soft. You could land an aircraft on the runways, but you couldn't get enough airspeed to take off. So we just sat there for about 2 days without anything to eat and just looking at each other. It was cold as blazes and raining cats and dogs. Finally, a Dakota aircraft came over from Whitehorse with a sergeant cook on board. So as soon as he landed, he immediately went up and fired up the stove and started churning out food for us, which we really did appreciate. But Norman Wells was an interesting place. There was, during World War II, at the height of the concern about the Japanese invading Alaska, etc., they wanted to have a supply of fuel to the northwest coast, so that they started building a pipeline from Norman Wells over to Whitehorse. Now, Norman Wells had been a small oil field which had been in operation, probably started sometime in the 1930s. They started working on it. In fact, they completed this pipeline just around the time the war ended, so it really wasn't put into use. But to construct it, they had actually acres of equipment, trucks, bulldozers, digging machines and everything else. And at war's end, they were just left across the river from Norman Wells in a place called Canal. There was just hundreds of vehicles there, just all lined up and just left, because the American industry, I think, had convinced the government that all of this equipment which they'd produced during the war and sent overseas was to be left there, because they wanted to make new equipment, of course. So that it was really interesting flying over and seeing all that equipment. But anyway, that was the Norman Wells operation. So with that, I guess I've pretty well covered the detachment at Whitehorse. And we finished sometime in September and then flew back to Rockcliffe in Ottawa, and from that point through the winter, we were flying on. I was flying on a DC-3, flying with a ski equipped DC-3, flying in northern Quebec when they're installing a radar chain called the Mid Canada Line. So that was fairly interesting flying up there. And one thing I recall seeing was a herd of caribou, probably hundreds of them, you know, just roaming along, just hundreds of them. But that the Mid-Canada line was sort of a radar, they called it a fence. In other words, it didn't have radar sets itself. It transmitted frequencies, radar signals from one station to the other, and if anything passed through it airborne, it would create a signal. And one of the problems was, of course, that the flock of geese would do the same thing, so they had to get used to that. But yeah, that's what we would do in the winter. Then in the following spring, we had the 1956 detachment. We flew it out of Churchill, Manitoba, with advanced bases in Cambridge Bay and a dew line site, which was one of the main dew line sites, called Fox, Maine, which was just in the tip of Fox Basin in the mainland, north of Hudson's Bay in that area. So I was flying strictly on Lancasters during that operation. The support crews, of course, they couldn't use the canso anymore. It was strictly the DC-3, and because they did their operation before spring breakup, so they could get into these places with a ski equipped aircraft, and to help them, they hired local Inuit people with their sled dogs, and they'd land as close as they could to a site, and then unload the dogs, hitch them up on their sleds, and load all the gear on their sleds, and off they'd go up to the point where the station was set up. And instead of having tents, of course, in this weather, we had insulated huts, which were sort of put together piece by piece rather than a canvas tent. And in a way, they felt this a little better. They didn't, of course, they didn't have the bugs to bother them. They just had a bit of cold, and they're well insulated and with lots of fuel, so they're okay. There's one problem with the sled dogs was that if the flying was a bit rough, they'd tend to get airsick, and they would regurgitate the seal meat and fish that they'd been fed on. So that was something else. But they certainly did help out. Now, flying in the Lancasters at we would go up for period of about a week and fly out of Cambridge Bay. There wasn't a decent airstrip there. In fact, they're just building it at that time. So we landed on an ice strip on Cambridge Bay. And after one Shoran flight, we came in to land on this ice strip. It was around midnight, but at that time of year, of course, it was sort of twilight. But the visibility wasn't all that great. And what had happened was that the snow had been drifting over the ice strip, and there was a patch of snow on the left-hand side, whereas where we're landing, whereas the right-hand side would have been bare ice. So when we started to brake, the brakes caught on the left-hand side, but not so much on the right. So the aircraft swung around into a snowbank on the left-hand side, stood on its nose, breaking the nose window, and then slamming down on the tail. And as a result of that, the fuselage of the Lancaster had a bend in it like a hockey stick. It was something else. Some of us thought it was a bit funny, except the pilot, because he said to him, in fact, we're sat there, he said, switches off, engines off, switches off, and then he said, there goes my chance for a permanent commission. I think he was right, because he seemed to have disappeared.
Really?
The CO didn't like people banning his aircraft.
No kidding.
Yeah, he had a job to do, and he was determined that it would be done. So anyway, that was that little story, but anyway, The rest of the detachment, we moved on from Cambridge Bay. Actually, we flew up to Resolute, also Resolute and Fox Lane. Now, I spent a lot of time in Resolute later on when I got into the recce flight, which I did just after this detachment. Now, the final year of Choran, the CO took on the detachment himself. He was determined that he was going to get the glory for it. But they had a detachment in Resolute Bay and another one in Thule Greenland. The American government was so keen to have this job of mapping the Canadian Arctic completed that they told the Strategic Air Command, which was Thule Greenland's base, to give us full access, and there was no questions about if we had full access. Mind you, flying on the recce flight with the early warning gear I had on the aircraft, I make a remark to the crew that there's an anti-aircraft radar has locked on to us as we're on the circuit. They were probably just practicing, mind you, but you can pick up. You can always pick up a signal when something is locked on because it changes from a search to a lock-on pattern with just straight pulses. So you could tell when that happened. But anyway, they gave us full access, and once again, they used the Eskimo sled dogs for doing the installations, and everything went well. They wrapped it up in I think it was probably around the 1st of May, but that summer, in April it was, I flew one of my most interesting trips. But first, before we get to it, I must tell you about the recce flight. Squadron Leader Ken Brown set up his own recce flight, and this was strictly for flying surveillance in the Arctic, and especially aimed towards the Soviet ice islands and things like that. To start off, he organized a course on Russia for us. They found a very well-experienced advisor to the Canadian government. His name was Kadanov Mikulski. In fact, he retired out in Victoria here, and he was a member of RUSI until he died about maybe 10 years ago. But anyway, he told us all about the Soviet Union, etc. And then for our missions, we were given a modified version of the Lancaster, which was called the Arctic Reconnaissance version. That it had a few modifications, mainly in equipment. It had a search radar, it had early warning receivers, improved cameras, improved navigation systems and things like that. And that was designed strictly for that operation. So anyway, we had two different types of flights. They had code names. One was called the Air Romp, where we're told to fly around the high Arctic, around the Arctic islands, etc., and listen for signals. And at the same time, we're asked to do herd counts on caribou, muskox, polar bears, and things like that. I'll just have a
sip of coffee. Take a break anytime,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, take a bit of a break.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's fascinating, though.
Yeah, you get a bit thirsty. Mm. I'm not used to talking steadily.
No.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fascinating.
Anyway, my friend George was very impressed with what you did with him. He thought that was really great.
Oh, with our discussion just a couple
George,
days ago?
With George Baker, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. He actually left me with quite a few contacts. I've since talked.
Yeah, mainly, yeah, Mo Gates and Noel Funge, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Morris Gates said he was away for a couple of days, so when he returned, we'd jive into it, but...
This Ray Bourassa, I don't know whatever happened to him. He sort of disappeared. I don't know what happened to him, but he was an interesting guy. He was almost like a choir boy, except when he got drinking, then he'd be wild as can be. Yeah, he was quite a character. Now, the thing is awful.